Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson. Thank you for joining us today here on Guelph Politico. This should be another great interview for you. A big interview, at least to me, or at least to anyone who is familiar with political writing in Canada. Our guest today is author Chris Turner, whose recent book, The War on Science, Muzzled Scientists and Wolf of Blindness in Stephen Harper's Canada, has been called a must-read for any Canadian worried about the state of our democracy and essential reading for all Canadians. The topic of the book has to do with scientists and the struggle of scientists to be able to talk about science freely under Stephen Harper's government over the last 8 years. It's very interesting reading. I was very glad to be able to talk to Mr. Turner about it. First, let's do a little bit of an introduction for Mr. Turner. He is one of Canada's leading voices on sustainability, livable cities, and the global clean tech boom. His latest book is The War on Science, Muzzled Scientists and Willful Blindness in Stephen Harper's Canada, which came out in October of last year. He also wrote The Leap, which has been called one of the most arresting arguments for building a green economy yet in print, and the Globe and Mail said that. And he also wrote the books The Geography of Hope and Planet Simpson. He's written articles for a variety of publications, including The Walrus, The Globe and Mail, Report on Business, Canadian Geographic, and Time Magazine. And he also speaks regularly and has won many awards, including the National Magazine Awards. He's won 6 golds for that, which is 6 more golds than I have. Turner's book, The War on Science, is an arresting and passionately argued indictment by award-winning journalists Chris Turner, arguing that Stephen Harper's attack on basic science, science communication, environmental regulations, and the environmental NGO community is the most vicious assault ever waged by a Canadian government on the fundamental principles of the Enlightenment. From the closure of the Arctic research stations as oil drilling begins in the high Arctic to slashed research budgets in agriculture, dramatic changes to the nation's fisheries policies, and the muzzling government scientists, Harper's government has effectively dismantled Canada's long-standing tradition. And in talking to Chris Turner via Skype from his home in Alberta, we talked about that Canadian tradition, policies of the Harper government, how average Canadians might try and generate more awareness about this going into the 2015 election, and we wrap up with a discussion of one of Chris Turner's other books. I will let you guess which one. Chris Turner, thank you for joining me via Skype today.
Happy to be here.
Great. Your new book, War on Science, it's certainly created some conversation, although a lot of people have been talking more about more pressing scandals, things like the sponsorship scandal and the current Veterans Affairs scandal. But how did you get started in the researching this book, and what about the topic interested you to pursue it?
Right. Well, it sort of began with Bill C-38, the Omnibus Budget Bill of 2012. Now, I've been, obviously paying pretty close attention to what the Conservative government have been doing for years, but that in particular seemed like a pretty extraordinary statement of the government's true agenda. And I remember seeing sort of the reaction to it. And there was a bit of attention paid to the rewriting of the Fisheries Act and that sort of thing. But a certain amount of the commentary seemed to be, the sort of mainstream, consensus seemed to be, well, it turns out that, this is not such a radical government. They're not doing anything major, they're tightening belts and that sort of thing. And certainly if you were looking at it from like a climate and environmental point of view, that it was a pretty radical document, actually. So I think that's where my interest began. And then I wrote a short magazine piece just looking strictly at the way certain scientists were being directly muzzled and not permitted to talk. And clearly there were a lot of little bits and pieces that if you put them together, you know, sort of painted a picture of this agenda, but they hadn't all been put together in one place. So that was really the motivation. And right around the time I was sort of toying with that idea, the Death of Evidence March happened in the summer of 2012, and clearly there were, you know, more than just me had noticed that this was a pretty radical break from previous governments, particularly in terms of their disposition toward science in general, and especially certain kinds of climate environmental science.
At what point did you decide one magazine article isn't enough, that there's enough here that you could create a whole book out of it?
Well, I mean, I think it was doing that research that basically the talking about the muzzling really just seemed like a one small piece of the larger puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I knew it didn't need to be a huge book, and it's not. It's a fairly tight narrative, but there just wasn't anything. I mean, you could have worked as a magazine article as well, but I wouldn't have been able to get as much in depth about, like, you're really discussing, here is how this is a break from previous government. Here is where, you know, the experimental lakes area came from, where, you know, some of these other sort of traditions of government science came from. Be able to really discuss in depth things like how, you know, what seemed like pretty minor changes, maybe from outside, really upset an organization like the National Research Council internally, that sort of thing.
Well, one of the interesting things for me in the book is that it's not is that history, is that going back and looking at this isn't a new type of conservative government where, you know, conservative and conservation almost seem to go hand in hand in the Mulroney years, but this is an entirely new thing. Can you talk about that history a bit?
Yeah, well, I mean, and in fact, that was, I mean, some of it was revelatory to me. I certainly didn't start the book thinking, oh, I will wind up talking about what a great job Brian Mulroney did. But Mulroney's environment ministry was a really, really active, leading role kind of group. As I mentioned in the book, I don't think it's incidental that, you know, one of the senior advisors in that ministry was Elizabeth May. Certainly her career trajectory, I think, indicates how far this conservative government has come from, you know, in just a generation. But I mean, you go even further back, and really, you know, a lot of the foundational aspects of Canada's environmental stewardship programs, the whole idea of civil service being an arm's length professional body where merit and the quality of the evidence is going to determine, you know, what the job is and who's going to do it. That goes back to Robert Borton, who was also a conservative reformer, and it really is a deep conservative tradition in Canada to be careful stewards of the environment, and this government has really abandoned it. I mean, you see in climate change particularly, we were having a much more mature, serious, important conversation about climate change when the science was still brand new and much more uncertain in the late 1980s under Brian Mulroney than we are now.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I think is perhaps most insidious in people's minds in terms of the book and the topic of the muzzling of scientists is that we kind of associate this thing with more American politics too. And of course, we're not just talking about environmentalism, because you get into things like the long form census in the book, which is you ball that into an attack on evidence based research. How shocking do you think it is for Canadians to learn that this American style kind of attack on science isn't as foreign as we like to think?
Right. Well, I would say that is maybe part of the reason why it took a while for Canadians to start paying closer attention, is because I think we still, particularly on environmental issues, particularly on the sort of on that front, we sort of prided ourselves in being, you know, leaders on that front, you know, being responsible stewards. We take great pride in our national parks program, all that kind of stuff. Particularly for, you know, Canadians today, if you look back at, you know, leadership on acid rain, leadership on the depletion of the ozone layer, early leadership on climate change, I think we sort of assume, you know, whoever the government of the day is, that foundation, you know, perseveres and will live on. And so it took a while for us to really accept the extent to which we'd abandoned, or that had been abandoned, not that we'd necessarily, not that the Stephen Harper's conservatives had started to really actively dismantle it. So I think that's part of the reason why it was a sort of slow dawning to realize this is a very big shift, and where you needed something in the end as powerful symbolically as scientists marching in the street in their lab coats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, clearly saying, and you know, I interviewed a bunch of them for the book, that so many of them saying, you know, I never thought I'd march in the streets. You know, I'm a scientist. The last thing I want to do is protest. But we are seeing, you know, the sort of fundamentals of what we do as scientists being challenged and in some cases thrown out by this government.
Was it difficult for you to find scientists who wanted to speak on the record, or was there any kind of trepidation on their part about, you know, dangers to future employment or reprisals or anything like that?
Yeah, well, there's no question that the people who are still actively employed by the, you know, still, you know, working as scientists in the civil service, they're not talking much. There have been, you know, a few cases, they were mostly third party, that, you know, a few talked to particular journalists. Usually off record, and I sort of quoted from those. I did have a couple of sources, including, you know, one guy in particular was really helpful at National Research Council. But there's no question that, you know, inside this government, the attitude is, you know, don't speak publicly about anything. And you know, there's a story I recount actually in the book of the Ottawa Citizen trying to get a scientist on the record talking about a study of snow and it turning into this sort of fiasco that took. You know, hours and ultimately a freedom of information request to find out why they decided that no one could talk to the media. Certainly the people who, you know, outside government who work closely with government scientists, they were very willing to talk and very concerned about what's going on. Recently retired scientists have been very willing to talk. And since the book's come out, you know, I've done a lot of speaking at universities and other places in public, and the response has been pretty overwhelming, both people working in government and even just, you know, research scientists at universities who've seen their NSERC funding, you know, seriously messed with, that, you know, I knew going into this that it was probably going to be pretty, like, and decided, you know, I'm not going to try and do an investigative journalism piece. I could be spending the next 5 years trying to get a dozen scientists on the record, and then even then you'd say, well, that was a handful of disgruntled scientists who saw their funding cut or whatever, and decided it was more important to really just sort of tell the story of what's happened so far rather than go the investigative route. That said, I mean, I've certainly I can't think of a single government scientist that I've heard from who said, you're way off, or that's simply not the case, or doesn't represent the reality that I'm seeing.
Mm-hmm. How about even further up? Were you able to, or was this even part of your plan in writing the book, to address the actual government members and ministers at these departments to find out why there's been such a shift, or why there's, even from their point of view, a perceived shift in how they relate to science and the way they present science?
Right. And that, again, that was both a logistical sort of practical concern and one of focus.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, I mean, every single member of this government or former member of this government that I quote in the book, I didn't speak to any of them directly, has had ample opportunity to explain what they think and why they're doing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
They get no shortage of attention. And they use it almost exclusively now to repeat the same talking points, to say nothing of any substance. And so I sort of decided fairly early on that going to interview whoever happened to be the environment minister right now was, you know, an exercise in sort of frustration and futility of anything useful out of it. I did try and contact Jim Prentice's office. I heard no response at all. I thought he would have been a fascinating person to speak to on this, but I can understand why he wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And really, more than anything, my interest was in telling the story that the government wasn't telling, rather than giving them yet another platform to repeat the same things that they did. And again, I mean, aside from, I've now, the book's been out for a while, I've been on, you know, radio and TV and in public forums on a couple of occasions. There have been either members of the government or strongly sympathetic kind of surrogates involved in forums and debates that I've been involved in, and they repeat the same talking points. I can recite them if you want to hear them. That we're spending more money than any other government on science, which is true if you don't adjust for inflation. It doesn't get to the question of what kind of science you're funding. That's one. They list off the numbers of, you know, we get this many media requests a year and we answer this many of them, and what more can you expect? And again, it doesn't get to who are you answering and under what circumstances. So really, you know, typical of this government, they just, you know, kind of dodge and obfuscate and redirect and don't do anything to actually address the question that's being asked of them.
Well, one of the things you talk about in the book is there have been ministers who have come up and have let, you know, little cracks of light, if you will, to show that they kind of understand what they're talking about, even if they can't come out and say that they understand what they're talking about. And that there does seem to be ideological cracks in the government right now. They aren't the united front they once were.
Yeah, I mean, there haven't been major fissures. I mean, there have been, yeah, I agree, there's, you know, a little bit more dissent in the ranks, so to speak. There's Michael Strong's, you know, Democratic Reform Bill. There will, you know, have been a couple of high-profile departures or, you know, in the case of Brent Rathgaber, you know, crossing of the floor.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly get the sense that there is a lot less monolithic agreement on this stuff. I mean, there are some smart people in that caucus who I think, you know, really do respect the work that's done at places like the Experimental Lakes area and are probably quietly troubled by some of these cuts. But the current sort of atmosphere in Parliament is, you know, loyalty above all else, unity above all else. Don't question, just execute. And for now, that does, I think, still hold sway. And I'm not optimistic, actually, that we will see any significant change in policy direction or general attitude or tone on this stuff or anything else until we see a change in government.
Well, let's talk about motivations a bit, because a lot of it is tied, of course, to the resource extraction business, things like the tar sands. Is that the extent of it, though? Because that really seems simplistic to me to sort of pave over all this tradition, all this scientific process all these people have put in years of their lives to, you know, monitoring water health and the planet's health. Is this a purely business thing, do you think?
No, not purely. I do think that's a big component of it. So if you think about what do they gain by doing this, there's sort of three main things. The first one is the obvious, or what goals are met by it. So the first one is, you know, yes, it potentially could make it quicker and easier to do large-scale resource development, which does generate a lot of income in the near term. In addition to that being good for the, you know, business interests that this government is quite close to, quite sympathetic toward, it's also, you know, if the economy is strong, if you can balance the budget, that sometimes helps shift the polls, and they're very focused on how to, you know, stay elected mm-hmm. and stay in power. So that's the first piece. I think there's a second piece, though, which is a larger ideological piece, in a sense, which is just a general sense that government shouldn't be in the business of doing much of this stuff anyway. Regulation and monitoring and basic scientific research, that's not government's job. Government's job is to pave the way for business, make sure the economy's running well, monetary policy, defense, security, crime stuff, everything else is, you know, healthcare, you got to run, education, you've got to fund or whatever, but getting into, you know, elaborate rules and regulations and funding studies to figure out the, you know, that's not, someone else will do that. You know, let the academics do that or something. That's not government's job. So part of it is that. That's why I think that's a second big piece.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing I think is the mistrust or misunderstanding of scientific expertise generally. That these things are not, that scientists are, in a sense, particularly in the environmental sphere, climate scientists, environmental scientists, are actually kind of activists in disguise, and why would we employ a bunch of anti-government activists in our own midst? So I think there's a little bit of that, this sense of, you know, you call yourself a climate scientist, but really what you are is an environmental activist, you know, digging up scientific research to try and get in the way of the running of government and the orderly growth of business and the rest of it. So I don't think it's just, hey, we want to do a favor for the oil and gas industry. And in fact, I mean, you know, I think there's a strong argument to be made that this dismantling of regulations, this sort of our way or the highway, incredibly divisive style of resource development has not helped even the oil and gas industry, which is the, you know, presumably first among equals in the resource development business, at least as far as this government's concerned. I mean, things have, you know, none of this has led to project and pipeline approvals that they want. It's actually creating more headaches than it's solving. So I don't think anyone is actually served by this. I think, you know, business likes to have a lot of certainty. They like regulations to be clear and fair and applicable to everyone, and none of that is happening right now.
I'm glad you mentioned the misunderstanding of the scientific process, because one of the things I see in a lot of online comments is people don't understand sort of the terminology of science. When you say things like impossible and with 100% certainty in science. Those are really big, heady concepts for a scientist to get his or her head around. A scientist doesn't say, this is impossible, or this is a certainty. So, you know, in terms of getting the word out and talking about this issue, how much of that is, you think, the average person's inability to wrap their head around the mind of a scientist?
Well, I mean, I think that that's certainly been exploited by this government, by lots of conservatives, particularly in the climate change discussion, but in lots of others as well, is that, you know, there is, you know, what the how the scientific method operates, what is meant by uncertainty, these sorts of things are very, very different when scientists are talking to other scientists than when people are talking to people generally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, great example that I forget who I first heard say this, but is, you know, like, there's not 100% certainty around the theory of gravity,
mm-hmm.
but you don't walk out the second story window of your house every day.
Yeah, I've used that one.
Yeah, and I think that's a pretty solid explanation of what scientists mean by uncertainty versus what you know, the general public might, or what a politician trying to score points might. I think that's been exploited. I think there's the nature of science that it's, you know, it does happen over long time periods. It's often, it seems very obscure, and it's very easy to kind of point at a particular study and say, why are we funding this, you know, this meaningless little study of bacteria in some lake somewhere or whatever it is, you know. And you know, the general sort of scientific literacy and trust in expertise is low, and that's all being exploited. At the same time, I think, you know, you certainly see, and I talk about this in the book with the National Research Council, where, you know, as one of my contacts there was saying, you know, like, it's at the one hand, there's a certain sort of contempt or dismissiveness about science, but on the other hand, there seems to be this sense that scientists are, you know, they're so smart and brilliant that, you know, if we get a call on our 1-800 number to say, hey, we need this kind of widget, you know, next month, we can just take a bunch of people who are working in a totally different scientific field and move them over into another part of the National Research Council and make that happen. As if, the, you know, just it's totally misunderstanding the level of specialization and expertise that it takes to do research at the level that's happening at the NRC.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it does seem to be, like, as that contact put it, it's this sort of, as he put it, small-town hardware merchant approach. Like, you know, let somebody else worry about, you know, what eggheads are doing what. What we want to, what we're interested in is what's going to make us money right now or next month. Those larger questions are just things that, you know, it is convenient for this government to not look at too closely.
I'm sure you've, or I'm not sure, I know that as a writer it's sometimes hard to read your own criticism or criticism of your writing, but, you know, have you looked at some of the counterarguments some people have come up against your book, and how do you respond to things like scientists are just interested in protecting their own jobs and other kind of criticisms like that?
Well, yeah, I'm certainly familiar with the criticisms of my book and that argument. You know, the argument scientists are taking their own jobs. These guys are only doing it for the research money and the rest of it. The single quickest, easiest, most lucrative way to fame, fortune, and success in the environmental sciences would be to disprove climate change or mm-hmm. disprove any substantial amount of, you know, that as a matter of fact, you know, tailings ponds turned out to be wonderful for the environment or whatever. You know, that would be, you know. Getting almost off topic here, but Bjorn Lomborg is a statistician of questionable merit who is probably the most successful environmental writer of our time in terms of book sales and speaking contracts and the rest of it, because he argues against doing things about climate change. So it's not like the road to riches is to be sharply critical of you know, the fossil fuel industry and the current direction of our energy policy and our energy economy. So that, first of all. The other thing I would say is, you know, that's just not how science works. I mean, you would be a laughingstock among your peers if you were fudging stuff simply to, I don't know what, get fame and fortune and grants and publications. I mean, the entire, you know, scientific method dating back to Newton's time was built around the idea that there will be ways to you know, these things have to be verifiable by third parties, and if you're completely off base, you will be, you know, you'll be held accountable for that. So that's, I mean, I think that part doesn't have a huge amount of merit. Now, I've certainly also heard, oh, these are just, you know, these guys are just mad because their baby isn't getting funding. Mm-hmm. And that's really not the tone that I've heard. I mean, it's not that, you know, the researchers who were working at the experimental lakes area, it wasn't that it was a super cushy job and they really loved it. It was that they and other scientists around the world thought it was some of the most important aquatic biology being anywhere. It was a one-of-a-kind laboratory. It was like shutting down the Large Hadron Collider. And so I think that, you know, that these are convenient, and again, it plays on, you know, the general public's maybe lack of depth of knowledge of what scientists do day-to-day and how research happens. But in any case, I mean, you know, I am not surprised to, you know, ad hominem is kind of the last refuge argument. You start attacking people for their self-interest without any evidence of it. You start attacking, you know, who they are as people or what their alleged beliefs are or alleged motivations are. It's because you can't argue against the basic fact, which is that this was really important work that has been cut without anything like an explanation beyond, well, tough times. And none of these was a big enough item on the budget to have justified that.
And that's, I think, one of the really interesting things you did with the book is paint a picture that, you know, it costs more to put a environmental action plan ad on during Hockey Night in Canada than it is to keep a lab open for a couple of years.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the what is it? That's $120-odd million now in economic action ad spending. Not even, like, general marketing and communications. All of which, by the way, that's the single largest growth part of the Environment Canada budget, for example, is marketing and communications. But yeah, like $120-odd million. This was a good, you know, $28 million just to advertise the or sort of celebrate the War of 1812. If these are such tough economic times, why does that spending make sense and not, you know, basic research and monitoring and oil spill emergency response centers and high Arctic research stations and all kinds of stuff that, you know, no one else is going to do. And that serve a definite purpose. I mean, what purpose is actually served by economic action plan ads other than to make us feel good about our government or like they're doing a good job? Well, that's not what taxpayer money's for. And it's a huge chunk of money. So, yeah, I mean, I think that reveals the transparency of the agenda at work, that, you know, money or the cost or, the, you know, we do, you know, these aren't luxurious things. I seem to recall, was it Peter Kent when they were killing the National Roundtable on Environment and the Economy, sort of saying, you know, I don't have that much money in my pocket, do you? Which is just a, you know, facile way to talk about government spending.
So looking forward, you know, there is an election next year. Do you think this is going to play a part in that process at all? I mean, politics is always fluid and there seems to be a new scandal every week, but do you think that people are going to be questioning their MPs and their conservative candidates or their political candidates in terms of how their politics are going to impact science after 2015?
Well, I think some places more than others, perhaps. More than that, I think it feeds into a growing sense that this is a government that has moved far away from its own stated values, far away from its own conservative traditions, and is really, you know, has sort of lost the plot. So I don't, you know, will the ballot box question in 2015 be the experimental lakes area and the muzzling of scientists? Probably not. Mm-hmm. But does it fit with a larger pattern of, you know, contempt for expertise, abandonment of basic Canadian values around stewardship and you know, responsible citizenship in the world and representative democracy and the rest of it? Yes. And I think that those are, you know, mounting concerns for a lot of Canadians. I mean, it's not surprising to me that you know, basically, you know, at most a quarter of Canadians are still supportive of this government. Mm-hmm. And it's because they are not speaking for the vast majority of Canadians anymore, if they ever did.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes left. I wanted to ask you a question a bit off topic because I was a fan of your other one of your other books, Planet Simpson. And it's connected because there's that famous Krusty the Clown quote about how everywhere he goes he sees scientists and Ferraris and teachers drinking champagne. But I was just wondering, are you still a fan of the show, and are you still watching it even in, you know, in year 25?
Well, to be honest, I don't watch the new episodes with near as much zeal. There's a great sort of online essay book thing, Zombie Simpsons. I think they kind of nailed it, that it's a fundamentally different show that continues to walk the earth.
Mm-hmm.
What I watch most of all now, I've actually got an 8-year-old daughter, and mm-hmm. And she's discovered the Simpsons on DVD in the sort of first 10 years, and we watch those quite a bit. And when you have, particularly if it's been a while, it's been a few years since you've revisited some of that sort of golden age stuff. It's pretty magical. It was, you know, it is, I think, standing the test of time. And certainly, I think, does have, you know, you watch how politics plays out in The Simpsons, and you can see a lot of the, you know, Harper Conservatives MO at work in, you know, Mayor Joe Quimby and Sideshow Bob and Mr. Burns. And the rest, they all practice the same sorts of tactics, for sure.
Oh, and they certainly have a more idealistic view of Canada than a lot of people these days who live here. Well, I appreciate your time, Chris. The book was great. I hope every Canadian gets a chance to read it and think about what it has to say before going to the polls next year. It certainly is a mindful, and I thank you for writing it.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for the interest. It was good to talk.
Good talking to you, too. Thanks a lot. And once again, that was Chris Turner, author of the book The War on Science, Muzzled Scientists, and the Willful Blindness in Stephen Harper's Canada. And that's it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. If you want to hear more of the Politicast, just click on the Guelph Politicast logo on the right-hand side of the blog, and that will take you to our host Podbean, where you can listen to all the previous episodes of the Politicast so far. The theme music for Guelph Politicast is by Go280 and the Yui Shank Band, and stay tuned for future episodes of the Guelph Politicast featuring interviews with politicians and other people of interest from across Guelph. We're heading into an election year, so there'll be lots of interesting things to cover, so stay tuned for that, and keep coming back to Guelph Politico for all your latest political news and editorials and information from the city of Guelph and the province of Ontario, the nation of Canada, and indeed internationally. And of course, you can also listen to me every week, Thursdays at 5, on the Gang of Four on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, or anywhere in the world on CFRU.ca. We will see you next time.